C1A. Number 13A.
The subject which we are really fundamentally interested in is very simple. It's only 7 and 4. And it takes us years and years somehow to grasp 7 and 4. But fundamentally, it's always that. So if I take the liberty to always go over the 7 and the 4 over and over again, it is not because I don't want to say anything else, but yes, it's because that's piece of it. And if we have that, we have everything. But what I want to see and to convey is the danger that we think that if we have a concept of the 7 and 4 nicely tabulated on a piece of paper and notes, that we don't have it, that we only have a tabulation of it and not the substance of it, the thing itself. And the textbook shows now how to get the substance, the reality of what is symbolized through 7 and 4. And so the purpose of what I want to do is how to give that spiritual touch of what the 7 and 4 is. For instance, we have always seen that the 7 days of creation give us a very beautiful sense of the 7. We saw that the commandments give us the order of the 7, the Beatitude, the Lord's Prayer. But we could ask ourselves, why should we have these 4 big Bible teachings? Why not only 1? Well, they differ in substance very much, though they symbolize the 7. But they are written from 4 very different standpoints. The days of creation are written from the standpoint of the world as the world. And the commandments have the touch of the Christ in it. And the Beatitudes, the touch of Christianity. And the Lord's Prayer, the touch of science in it. But knowing that is no help at all. It's just stating something. And no statement has any spiritual power. Only spiritual qualities, only the inward unity with spiritual qualities have power. We'll see that in the 4th subject. So what we have to see, what is the spiritual import of, say, the days of creation and then the commandments? Now, take for instance the first day and the first statement in the commandments. What does it spiritually, inwardly convey? What is its life teaching? Well, it says, let there be light. It is that point where we begin to see that seeking for the light is the very first thing that is necessary. That is the initial point from where everything starts. Let there be light. What then is the purpose of the commandment, which says, I am the Lord thy God, which brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. What is the connection between? Well, the connection between must be not the mental one, but the very logical, living one. If I begin in my life to see, I see that seeking God will give me the answer to everything. Seeking God will mean finding God, and finding God will mean just everything to me. So seeking God is something in me which is just big and beautiful and beyond words. But it says to me, that's all right, but if you want to seek God, you can't at the same time seek something else. Seeking God means that God will free you, that seeking the light will mean that it brings you out of darkness. But seeking the light will also mean that we have to leave darkness and get out of Egypt. And so these two just hinge together. If I have the first day of creation and leave it at that, it's incomplete. I must go a step further. I must accept what this first day of creation involves. It involves that if I seek God, that God comes to me. That's the first thing it involves, that it will free me. But it will free me from what? From the contrary of life. from darkness, from Egypt. And so inward in me, if I want to fulfill the commandments and obey the commandments, somehow I have to comply to that first statement and leave the darkness and be willing to sacrifice the darkness. If I'm satisfied only with the first day, well, it doesn't oust darkness. It is not complete. And that's what we were seeing in the chapter on prayer. It says in the first subject, well, seek God as he is. And it brought us some sense of the revelation of what God is, those seven big indication of the seven synonymous terms. But Atonement and Eucharist comes and says, but bind your seeking and your desire to that strongly and strongly, and don't bind yourself to anything else. It comes and brings the demand to sacrifice, really, a false sense of mind, my own sense of mind. And it comes to us and says, practice only the gospel, namely the mind of Christ. And it says, and that brings you into a new life, it brings you into heaven, it brings you into an absolutely new mind, into the mind of Christ, which is alive. Can you see that connection? If we can reduce those two chapters really to just to the fundamental facts of the Word as the Word and the Word as the Christ, then we have done a big job. Then we have seen through all the exemplifications of the text. We have seen to the fundamental substance of the 7 and 4. Once again, prayer, the first subject in prayer, says desire is prayer. Desire for what? And it says the desire to know God in his full light, in his seven-hued light. That's the first point. It says, oh yes, inward in me is something, and in you has always been something, that enormous urgent desire to know God in his full light. Then comes the command in us and says, then let go the darkness. Let go any other seeking and desiring after another God. Let it go. And that only brings you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. It frees you from a false unity, from a false bondage with a false mind, from a bondage with a false mind. That's what Atonement and Eucharist says. The first subject in Atonement and Eucharist says that mind compels us and urges us to have unity with the one mind, God, and not to have any other unity with another mind. And therefore, it says in its scriptural text, there is the sacrifice of the false mind. There must be inward in us that willingness and happiness to say, oh yes, let all that other human mind go down the drain. Let it go. Let's preach the gospel. Let's practice from another standpoint, from the standpoint of mind, which is God. And that leads us into a complete new life, namely that life which is dictated by the mind of Christ. And so I'm getting freed from it. Can you see that? The depth of these 7 days and commandments and beatitudes and Lord's Prayer are quite deep, very deep. And if we have them, we have the 7 and 4 in its sense of the days of creation. And we have a lot. And it's perhaps only that we have taken them too literal and too superficial that we haven't seen the depth of it. You know exactly. You take the gospel like the gospel of Matthew. Well, the whole gospel of Matthew can be reduced to the 7 days of creation. Well, just to say it's the same pattern doesn't do a thing. But to see that the substance of the Gospel of Matthew is of the same pattern as the substance of the 7 days of creation, and seeing that substance and beginning to imbibe that substance, that does what it did for Jesus. That has power. That has reality. And so, more and more as we go on, I will try to reduce the substance of the text in the textbook to those 7 and 4. And the more we reduce it and the more we get hold of the 7 and 4, the more we have the system and the whole of it. Or you take the second subject in prayer, or let's first take the second day of creation, the second commandment or statement in the commandment. They says, let there be a firmament to divide. It gives the proposition of let there be a firmament which does divide. But we cannot always go on just dividing and say this is this and this is that. The commandment comes and says, now you have to make up your mind to which side you are going. Just to divide, to have a firmament which divides, you must now come to the point where it says, to which side are you going to turn? Are you turning to one or are you turning to the other? Meaning to us, well, that's what then the commandment says. It says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. It says, you must turn to the one God and leave the others. It forces us really to turn to the one and turn our back to the other. It is that which says, and now you have to choose. The command comes now to choose. The second day didn't give the command to choose. It says, and it divided. And it, so the word must be complemented by the Christ urging us, which says, now I see clear. This is right, this is wrong. This is good, this is evil. Now to which side I am going to turn? The command comes exemplifying now to what side you are turning. And so the dominant Eucharist comes in. Well, we saw that very clearly in the second subject in prayer. In prayer, if you can remember well, we saw there how she showed that if we worship the good, that worshipping the good meant bringing unfoldment. She said there that expressing spiritual qualities like consecration, gratitude, charity, obedience, habitual struggle for the good, and love, and so on, brings unfoldment. And at the same time, she says, and material worship hinders spiritual growth. She made the separation. She showed one side and the other side. And now in Atonement Eucharist, she comes and says, and now she begins writing that the command is, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Now turn yourself to the material, turn away yourself from the material worship. Turn yourself to the spiritual worship. It is there where she comes out now in and says, now it's the choosing. Now comes point of choosing, of the great decision. It's there where she says that Jesus paid no homage to ritualistic worship, that he made the decision. And she asked there for us to turn constantly away from material things and to turn constantly towards the imperishable things of spirit, where she urges to resist the worship of something material and always to worship spiritual. Can you see how in the Atonement Eucharist we always get the demand which is implied through the chapter on prayer already. The chapter on prayer gives us the first presentation of the fact, and then the Atonement Eucharist comes and says, you can't stay there. Now comes the point where we have to exemplify. To exemplify first that we want to bind our mind to the divine mind. Second, that we want to worship the spiritual and not the material. And therefore that we exemplify that by turning away from the material sense of life and turning towards the spiritual sense of and exemplifying it. So in that second subject of Atonement and Eucharist, we always get that sense that spirit, purity of spirit impels us spiritualization. See, in prayer, you had a presentation of that, that if we want to worship God, then if we do worship God spiritually, there will be progress and unfoldment. If we don't worship God spiritually, there will be stagnation. Here she comes and says, and because God is spirit and spirit is pure, it has in itself the power to drag us away from the fall and to push us towards the spiritual good, towards the imperishable things of spirit. And so just as in the commandment that comes, thou shalt have no other gods before me, meaning take me as the only God. And so we have to exemplify that. Well, last time we began with subject of soul, and we can see how the whole subject evolves quite naturally. In the first subject of mind, you see, she postulated, so to say, the law of atonement by saying, with your mind, with your whole inward activity, cling to the one God. Go and find your unity in God, not the other way around. Don't expect that God comes to you and find and reconciles himself with you. Mind is that which says, leave behind your human mind, your human thinking, and so on, and cling to the one mind, to that one man with God. And as she said that, she said, yes, but then thou shalt have no other God before me. Jesus asked the commandment, thou shalt have no other God before me. And so asked us to turn towards imperishable things of spirit. And she ends it up by saying, and if we do that constantly, constantly turning away from material sense, and if we are in earnest about it from the start, we will finish the course with joy. See how she shows that law of the 1, 2, 3, as I have shown it before again. Says, what is it that brings joy in us? What is it that brings spiritual understanding, joy, satisfaction, that talking of the spiritual sense in us? What is it that brings it? It's not just by saying it. It's not just because we know that's an idea of soul. No, it's something that evolves, that is being born to us through mind and spirit, only through that sense. It says it's born in that measure as we constantly turn away from material sense. And if in earnest, she says, then we will finish that course with joy. And a sense of joy comes in. A sense of joy and satisfaction comes in. So that third subject shows us how we have to constantly and earnestly do that turning away. And how that brings us to that firmness of soul and that definiteness of soul. How did she say, how did she present it? In the questionnaire, I put that question and said, can you see how in the third subject she always gives that sense of perseverance? That through that whole third subject goes a sense of perseverance, of pursuing a course, making vigorous efforts in a direct line, occupy till I come, be not weary in well-doing, go not back to error, you see, be persistent, persevering, don't go back to error, don't become a sluggard, be constant in self-immolation, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, be firm, be constant, you have got all that touch in it, you see. But she shows there, again, that order, how to get that constant, and that being constant and persevering shouldn't be a moral effort. You know, so often in life we say, oh, well, I have to be persevering, I have to stick it through. And then somehow one gets a straight back and say, well, I have to be very courageous and so on, and it's a willful effort. But that's not the divine law. It's not the divine order. That definiteness of spiritual understanding of which she speaks at the end of this third subject, she says, is the evidence gained from spirit. That definite of spiritual understanding is not something which we gain from learning it and from knowing that it is an idea of soul. We don't get it that way. It's something that must be born in us. And how does she say it's born in us? She says it's the evidence gained from spirit. And what was it that she presented in the subject of spirit? She said, that was it. That sense of, do we have enough love, affect and gratitude of prayer, that we can use the spiritual qualities in atonement and Eucharist to turn away from everything that is material, from material gods, from material worship, from material attraction, from a material center, from a material load and burden? Can we turn away from that? Have we Do we use that love which we have gained in prayer, that love for God, that affection for God, those spiritual qualities which we have seen are praying, are worshipping God, do we use them to turn away from the material? Do we use them to stick to the spiritual? And she says, and if we do that constantly, that was in spirit as love, if we do that constantly and persistently, that brings us into the definiteness of soul. That's given. It's given to us. It's not something which we somehow try to make our own. It becomes our own. You see, exactly what the third day of creation says. Third day of creation says exactly that. It says, by gathering together the waters of the second day, by gathering together the waters, the dry land appears. It comes by itself. That's the order and the law of the order. That fulfilling the second gives birth to the third. That fulfilling the second stage is giving birth to the representative of soul. So the dry land appears. Doesn't say, and God made the dry land. It appears. It appears. And that dry land, that identity, had enough in itself of the representative of soul that it could reproduce and represent and represent and reproduce and reappear the seed in itself. That always then, once we have that representative in us, begins to talk and represent the whole of God and talk to us what God has in store for us. So here, let's be quite clear, because religious thought comes in and says, I have to be perseverant, I have to stick it through. That's right, but if it's only right if we take it right. If we take it as that which we have gained through the gentle sense of prayer and the first two subjects of atonement and Eucharist. That gentle sense which says, yes, my mind goes out to God. I want to have that mind which is the divine mind. And which says in the second subject, yes, and in order to exemplify my earnestness in that, I turn away from that which is not God. Thou shalt have but one God. Thou shalt have no other God. And he gave to Caesar what was Caesar's, but he gave to God what was God. And by giving that, he at last paid no more homage to the priest and to Caesar and to anything. But he was at last one with the imperishable things of spirit. And then he was the representative of. Then something begins to talk louder and louder in us as the representative of soul. I don't know if I tire you. It's a bit hot in here and you may have a bit of struggle with sleep. But it's not that. If we can see that order as a spiritual birth and not as an enumeration of words, we have got some. We have got some. It will never lead us. We have got the seed in itself. That days of those days of creation, those seven synonymous terms, which are symbolized in the textbook through the subjects which we are dealing with, they are the sun. But it must be a birth. It mustn't be learning it by heart. It mustn't be saying, well, I know that. No, it must be a birth.